This is an ABC podcast. Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, Tonga reflects on 12 months of devastation and rejuvenation as it commemorates the one-year anniversary of the volcanic eruption and tsunami that gripped the world. Also today, we take a look at a plan to embed local Solomon Islands police in unexploded ordnance survey teams.
I certainly see this as a route to significant clearance for humanitarian purposes across the island so that, you know, people can you know, they can dig their ground safely.
And we hear from a woman who's breaking new ground for equality and women's rights in PNG and being recognised for it in Australia.
And we try to give a voice to the marginalised and women at all levels within an organisation, as well as men.
All that and more coming up on the program. I'm Nick Fogarty. It's great to have your company. Well, it's been just over a year now since Tonga was rocked on its foundations by the eruption of the Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai volcano. Whole island communities were displaced by the eruption and ensuing tsunami on the 15th of January 2022, as housing and infrastructure was destroyed and four people lost their lives. An exhibition has now been launched in Tonga to commemorate the one-year anniversary of the eruption. Cabinet Minister Samiu Vaipulu says Tonga is still recovering from last year's disaster. Here he is speaking at a commemoration ceremony over the weekend.
And we mark this first anniversary of this disaster. It is almost impossible to comprehend the power, the magnitude of the eruption. A year on, studies continue to try to understand the full extent of its impact.
One person who was an outlet for news from Tonga about the eruption and its aftermath was Brisbane-based broadcaster Suli Lei, who last year was bestowed with a special royal honour that allows him to speak on behalf of Tonga's king. He joins us now on the program. Good morning, Mr. Lei, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Malolele, and good morning. It's great to be here.
Yesterday, hundreds of people packed the Cathedral of St. Mary in Nuku'alofa for this commemoration. Were there similar services held in Brisbane, where you are?
Absolutely, and not just in Brisbane, but most of the Tongan denominations across Australia and the diaspora community. Definitely, it was a reflective mood yesterday, and also on Saturday as well on Pacifica TV and radio, we also broadcast a special reflective program, bringing together some of the various church ministers from around Australia through that program as well.
So what did it mean to the people of Tonga to be able to reflect on those terrible events of 12 months ago through these ceremonies over the weekend?
I think it's actually brought up a lot of emotions as people have sort of paused, taken a moment to reflect of what actually occurred back 12 months ago, and also a time to look at the support that the diaspora put together over the last 12 months, you know, through taking of supplies back to Tonga through containers. And in addition to that as well, there was obviously a lot of monetary support sent back to family and friends, and to also sort of look back and see how have we gone with the recovery process back in Tonga.
And I understand there was an exhibition also held as part of the anniversary commemoration. I think that was in Tonga. Do you know what that exhibition involved?
Yeah, absolutely. So government departments, NGOs and some of the private sector got together and put on an exhibition which was held at the Queen Salote Memorial Hall in the heart of Nuku'alofa. Those displays included each department from the government, the NGOs, had displays with photographs, pictures showing the relief efforts, showing the damage of various areas and showing efforts up to this stage where they've gone in terms of recovery, rebuilding the infrastructure that was impacted, both natural infrastructure as well as the physical infrastructure. Of course, there was, you know, geologists display and so forth. So it was an opportunity for both the public as well as various departments to come together to walk through those displays and reflect and to see the journey of what had occurred in Tonga right through until the recovery efforts up to date.
And speaking of that infrastructure that has been damaged and destroyed, Mango and Atata Islands especially were devastated by the disaster, and they're now totally deserted. Their populations have just been resettled in new communities in recent weeks. As far as you know, have those resettlements all gone smoothly?
Yeah, it's interesting. Displacement was definitely one of the key issues that the Tongan government obviously had to deal with in the wake of the tsunami and the volcanic eruption. And some of those people were residing in community halls, church halls, for almost a year until just, like, as you've mentioned, a few weeks ago, where they've been relocated. I mean, generally speaking, and I was in Tonga a few weeks ago, that process has gone quite smoothly. But at the same token, that, you know, there's a few members of those community groups that are longing to go back to the islands, keeping in mind that their ancestors are buried on those islands, that there's unique links to those areas. And of course, for some of the people from those islands, you know, they were fishermen and so forth, and now they've been moved to completely different locations and areas. So it's a big adjustment for these people, notwithstanding also the trauma that people have gone through as well, and being located, not going back home, but going to a different area as well, also conjures constantly the reason that why we were moved in the first place. So it's an interesting transition for these people, but of course the government and the other NGOs have worked hard to rebuild some infrastructure in new areas for them. We need to take the advice from scientists and geologists and so forth in preparation that this could happen again in the future, and their islands have been deemed not safe for them to rebuild there. So hopefully moving forward, they're in a lot more safer zones for protection against future tsunamis.
I was reading earlier a story of a man, I believe he was from Atata Island, and he got actually washed out to sea, and he had to swim some incredible distance, and then he basically washed up on the beach at Nuku'alofa, and his whole family thought that he had died, and they stayed up all night kind of praying that he had survived. Have stories like this of this kind of survival, have they, you know, staggered you? You know, what do you think when you hear these stories?
I think for us living in the diaspora, and given Tonga Tapu's geography, it's a very flat island, of course. And I think well before this tsunami happened, people were always sort of the Tongan community would often joke and say, oh gosh, you know, when a tsunami ever happened, you know, Tonga Tapu would be gone. It's as flat as a pancake, you know, there's no mountains and so on. And then when this actually occurred, the immediate concern from diaspora straight away was that the death toll would be huge, given Tonga's geography. However, hearing those survival stories and hearing that the death toll was so incredibly low was just absolutely, you know, that was so shocking in itself. I believe that everyone, you know, all experts included, were expecting a much higher death toll. So that survival story was phenomenal when we heard it. And as we got the statistics coming in terms of, you know, what areas were damaged and what areas survived, I think even to now we're just thanking God that it could have been so much worse.
Mm. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia, and we're speaking with Brisbane-based broadcaster and Tongan community member Suli Lay. Suli, with the official royal role that you now hold, along with your responsibilities as a broadcaster, have you personally felt additional pressure to be a pillar of strength for the Tongan community over the last year?
That's a very interesting question. I don't think I've felt any additional pressure. I think as a community, we all pull together no matter what role we play in the community. Everyone knows their role. They know what they're expected to do. If anything else, it's just been a really honouring opportunity, and I think it's quite appropriate here to acknowledge the great work of Tonga's High Commissioner in Canberra, Her Royal Highness Princess Angelika Latifuipeka Tuku'aho, of course, is the only daughter of His Majesty King Tupou VI, who led what was called the Pilia Tauhala National Committee. So Her Royal Highness brought together a national committee. I was a member on that committee as well, and Her Royal Highness coordinated the diaspora communities of each state and territory across Australia so that there was a national consensus on how to work in together with the support that we did from the Australian community anyway to the Kingdom of Tonga. And part of that was that Her Royal Highness was able to negotiate through Swire shipping containers. A total of 42 containers were sent from New South Wales, Victoria, Canberra and Brisbane communities to send back to Tonga, in addition to multiple fundraising initiatives and donations from the Australian business sector, as well as other embassies that had their embassies based in Canberra. Phenomenal effort, and it was an absolute pleasure to be part of that, and just to feel that we're doing something as a community and working together for the good of Tonga and for the rebuild of the nation.
Certainly. And the eruption was the largest ever recorded by modern equipment. And there were some simply staggering statistics which continue to be released. For example, the eruption actually propelled water vapor beyond the Earth's atmosphere into space, as well as causing 25,000 lightning events in 5 minutes. Did the people of Tonga have any idea that the Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai volcano contained this much power?
Talking to people on the ground during this trip over to Tonga a couple of weeks ago, I spoke to so many different people, from business owners that have businesses along on the waterfront to people living inland in some of the villages there. And certainly the feedback I received was that the days leading up to the actual eruption, that there was a lot of noise coming from the volcano. People were looking out to that direction of the ocean from Nuku'alofa, and they could see there was like a storm brewing on the horizon. There was a lot of lightning and so on. They also said to me that the water looked like it was almost boiling at points along the waterfront. It was the ocean was swirling. Some of the ship captains told me similar scenarios. So the signs were quite different from, you know, when you have an earthquake or a cyclone and so on. So this was quite new for people. But when it actually exploded, they said that nothing prepared you for the seismic boom. And just the magnitude of the eruption itself is something. And then, of course, the continued eruption after the initial seismic boom was like bombs going off in the distance. It was like a war zone. It was quite something they'd never experienced before. And, of course, we only know from looking at the pictures on television and how that massive mushroom cloud just starts in the Tongan Islands, just spreads across neighboring nations. It was so huge. And then in Tonga, they were with tsunamis in the past, you've seen, you know, the water would recede. But in this case, the water just surged from where it was and it went up so high, you know, into buildings along the waterfront, destroying and taking everything in its way and then sucking it back out to the ocean. And there's, like, talking to some of the doctors at Viola Hospital as well, the trauma that young children are experiencing, and they are very grateful to the Pacifica medical team from New Zealand who sent a lot of counsellors on shore. I think there's a lot of psychological, I suppose you could say, damage that people have experienced that perhaps even now we haven't seen the full impact of. That will be something to come over time. I did speak to some employers who said they lost employees who are not returning to work at all just due to the trauma of the whole experience. So I think there's some things we won't really see immediately, but there'll be a longer term impact that will come down the line.
Yeah, it's an incredible story, and I think we're all still just trying to get our heads around it. But no, it sounds like you're doing some fantastic work and fantastic work being done by all members of the Tongan community. Thanks very much for joining us, Suli.
Thanks so much, Nick. Malo aupito.
That was Brisbane-based broadcaster and Tongan community member Suli Lay. Well, a British NGO with an ambitious plan to rid Solomon Islands of unexploded bombs from World War II says they'll embed local police in their survey teams. It comes after a previous international contractor broke procedures, resulting in the deaths of two of its employees and the suspension of work. This year, the Halo Trust will start a landmark survey of Solomon Islands to assist future efforts in clearing bombs, which kill more than a dozen people every year in the country. Mackenzie Smith reports.
In Solomon Islands, the legacy of World War II is still taking its toll today. An unknown number of unexploded ordnances are strewn across dozens of battle sites where the US and its allies fought Japan between 1942 and 1945. But as Simon Conway, who leads the Halo Trust's development team, says, the ongoing deaths from these bombs are a problem that's still largely undetected.
As someone that's worked in this industry for nearly 25 years, I hadn't realised the scale of contamination from Second World War unexploded ordnance in the Solomon Islands. I think that's partly because there's just really been no record keeping.
HALO Trust was founded in 1988 to help clear landmines and other explosive remnants in Afghanistan before expanding these efforts to 17 countries. The organisation is undertaking a first-of-its-kind survey after it was awarded $1 million in funding by the US Department of State in December. Those funds will go toward creating a map of all unexploded bombs, especially at the sites of famous battles like in Guadalcanal and New Georgia. It's the first time Mr. Conway has worked in the Solomon Islands. He says he hopes the survey will help the country present a strong case to the international community to support future work removing bombs.
I certainly see this as a route to significant clearance for humanitarian purposes across the island, so that, you know, people can, you know, they can dig their ground safely.
HALO's contract in Solomon Islands is the first the US has supported since the NGO Norwegian People's Aid, which was cut short when two of its staff died from an old mortar shell explosion in 2020. An investigation by the NGO later found the pair had been handling the shell at their office and residence in breach of the organisation's rules. This time around, Simon Conway says there are stricter measures in place.
I had very frank conversations with the Solomon Islands government about, and you know, of course, they are justifiably concerned about it, but we've come to an agreement that there will be no movement of ordnance, which I'm thoroughly in favour of. And we also, I made a bid to them that we would actually embed members of the police EOD unit in our survey team. That would, I think, on the one hand, you know, increase the confidence in, as they see the work that we're doing, but also, frankly, it would benefit us.
Still, there are signs the 2020 incident has damaged trust between the police and international contractors. Karen Galokale, Permanent Secretary for the Solomon Islands Ministry of Police, National Security and Correctional Services, which coordinates clearing unexploded bombs, was quoted by Hawaii news site Civil Beat saying she was concerned there wasn't a memorandum of understanding struck with the HALO Trust. She declined to be interviewed by Pacific Beat. John Rodsted, Pacific Islands Coordinator for Safe Ground, an Australian NGO working to eradicate the harm from unexploded bombs, says cooperation between HALO and other partners in Solomon Islands will be critical.
The Solomons, in land mass and in where they actually have to go, it's really not that hard. But I hope they don't just go out and reinvent the wheel. Use the information that's available.
He says Australian forces stationed in Solomons could also provide vital assistance. HALO's Simon Conway says no matter how successful the survey is, the problem of unexploded bombs won't be going away anytime soon.
There's a lot of ammunition dumps in some of the remoter islands. I don't think we're going to finish the survey in 2 years, but we should get a really good picture of the problem by then.
HALO says in addition to the survey, it will construct storage for ammunition and detonators and support the Solomon Islands government in drafting new regulations for dealing with explosives.
Mackenzie Smith reporting. Now it's time for the latest news headlines from around the Pacific region. I'm joined by Kyle Evans. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Nick. How are you going?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Yeah, another Monday morning. Good weekend. Hope you had the same.
I certainly did. Now, a human rights group is calling for an end to Australia's asylum seekers. What concerns have they raised?
Yeah, so Human Rights Watch says Australia's 10-year policy to process asylum seekers is basically a stain on the country's international human rights reputation, and it needs to end now. So this follows the release of the group's World Report 2023, which came out last week. And in it, it stated there are about 90 people in Port Moresby and in Nauru who have been detained, essentially because they tried to enter Australia by boat a decade ago. So they've missed out on a number of work opportunities, study opportunities. They've also seen their physical and mental health damaged by that incarceration.
So what solution is the group offering?
Yeah, so ultimately they would like to see them settled in Australia as well as places like the United States in Canada. I'm actually speaking to a representative of that Human Rights Watch later on today. So we'll have a good interview hopefully tomorrow. So it'll be interesting to get some more information around that.
Yep, certainly looking forward to hearing what they have to say. Now, I understand a third mass burial of unclaimed bodies will take place in Papua New Guinea. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct, unfortunately. So a mass burial will be held for another 90 bodies to help ease an overcrowded situation at the Port Moresby General Hospital morgue. So this is reported by the Post Courier, and it comes after bodies started accumulating between August and December, which we've been reporting on at length. But unfortunately, it's just a bit of a situation that keeps on getting worse. So the hospital has released the names of the latest batch of bodies. Of the 94 are actually infants. And the hospital is calling for people to come forth and claim their loved ones within a 2-week grace period, or essentially risk having them put in a communal grave.
Well, certainly hope that can be sorted out fairly soon. Lastly, Fiji's new Prime Minister will make his first overseas visit as the Prime Minister. So where is he going?
Yes, new Prime Minister Sitiveni Rabuka and members of his delegation, they'll visit Kiribati on January 20. So this comes at the request of the Fiji government and will mark the first stop of an official engagement tour, which basically solidifies himself as the country's new leader among Fiji's neighbours. So, you know, pretty important for diplomatic ties. Yeah, and things like that.
Gained a bit of legitimacy there by visiting those leaders. Any word on what his itinerary will look like?
Yeah, not a ton. From what I understand, it's a pretty standard sort of diplomatic meeting. He'll meet with Kiribati's president as well as a number of senior cabinet ministers. You know, they'll discuss things like bilateral relations before staying overnight and leaving the next day. Interestingly, it's a pretty big deal for Kiribati. They've actually called upon church leaders as well as business leaders within the community to get the locals to sort of clean up their villages in preparation for the visit.
Well, good luck to them on that, and we'll hope to hear a bit more about all of those stories in the coming days.
Sounds good.
Thanks, Kyle. That's Kyle Evans with the latest news headlines there from around the Pacific.
Pacific Beat.
It is Monday, January 16, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I hope you all had a great and wonderful new year and you're settling seamlessly back into work. Still to come on today's show, we'll hear from a groundbreaking scholar who successfully raised issues of equality and equal rights in her PNG workplace. We'll also catch up with a nurse from Nauru who's spreading sexual health awareness, and Pacific leaders voicing fears over accommodation as more families of Pacific Island seasonal workers prepare to settle in Australia this year.
Tune in to SBS Samoan News on ABC Radio Australia. SBS Samoan News features independent news and stories connecting you to life in Australia and Samoan-speaking Australians by our friends at SBS Australia. SBS Samoan News. Tune in Mondays and Thursdays at 6:05 a.m. Samoan time for 1 hour of news in Samoan language on ABC Radio Australia.
Working as a nurse in Nauru, Constantina Depon saw women suffering due to a lack of knowledge around sexual health. She also discovered that issues like domestic and family violence were having a big impact on people's health. That's when she decided to apply for a scholarship to study in Australia, where she is now in the final year of a degree in public health. And she's just begun a women's leadership course as part of her scholarship through the Australia Awards program. Marion Farr caught up with the 39-year-old who talked about the social barriers some Nauruan women face in obtaining an education.
I've been in the medical field for more than 10 years. I'm a nurse and I'm also a midwife. Yeah, and I've seen that women got pregnant at young age, and there's a lack of motivation and there's lack of educational opportunities for them to continue their education, even though there's high school there. The mentality that I've been seeing, most of my mothers were telling me, like, you have no opportunities given to them because they are family at young age.
Mm.
When did you come to Australia to begin studying under the Australia Awards program, and what have you been studying?
I came to Australia in 2019 to do public health, bachelor's in public health. Basically, that's what I'm currently doing at QUT.
So that's based in Brisbane, right? And what was it that, I guess, motivated you to pursue that that sort of field of education? What did you want to achieve by doing a bachelor in public health?
With my background, nursing and midwifery, I did my university studies in Fiji. But when I went back to Nauru, the nurses' staff at Nauru, there's no pathway for us to further our standards. So that's what motivates me to do public health, is because I see that we need to educate women and families, because I'm a midwife. I've seen a lot of barriers and determinants that it's affecting the community. And that's what motivates me to do this program, because I wanted to go to the community and encourage people, my people and the women and family, especially the family, because I've seen a lot of problems coming into my clinic. For example, domestic violence, STIs, child abuse, and all sorts of negative health issues that are facing our current population. And I've seen that there's a gap in public health that needs to be strengthened. Because I believe that when we fix what is the problem up there, then I think the downstream part will be flowing. Like in the hospital, there won't be any more people coming into the hospital sick, and we need to educate our people. Yeah, I think we need to motivate them, giving the right information to them.
There's a lot about what you can do to prevent sort of negative health outcomes.
Yeah, circumstances, yeah.
So when are you due to finish up your studies in Australia?
This is my last year. That's why I took up this leadership program, so that it can help me gain some confidence in order to help my people. Yeah, especially the women.
How are you, how have you found the studies in Australia, and how are you feeling about graduating at the end of this year and then going back to Nauru?
This program, W, will help me develop that skills to address in the real world when I go back, is these issues that's influencing our mothers and the women in Nauru. This program will help me initiate that influence into my communities, especially when, for example, when mothers come into my clinic, I would ask them to do family planning, but they cannot make their own decision without the approval of their husband or their partner, and these really affected them. I've seen mothers coming into the clinic asking for advice. For instance, we have high-risk mothers with cardiac, and we've been advising her to take tube ligation, but she couldn't do it because of those, husband's decisions and the social norms that we have on our country, probably through religion. And these particular things that we need to address, it's really sensitive, so I would like to train more on this kind of stuff. I don't want to affect anyone in any way, but I just want to help them get the best help that they need in order to function in life, especially in their family.
That was Australia Award scholar Constantina Depon speaking with reporter Marion Farr.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Vani Nades is a businesswoman providing internet service to schools and communities in Papua New Guinea's rural areas. Technology in PNG can be expensive, but her business runs a charity using education to help people in rural communities access clean water, health and solar power. She spoke with the ABC's Carolyn Tiraman.
My core business is on internet service provider in the country. And with that, we have seen technology an enabler to rural connectivity, which is, our key focus where we go out to the rural places and give, access to connectivity to our people that really need it, our, unserved areas. So So, you know, I also have my other businesses like the co-working hub that we provide the necessary tools that entrepreneurs or SMEs or aspiring entrepreneurs need to help grow their business and also scale and connect them to businesses locally and, you know, globally as well. So we have an e-commerce platform. And again, it is a platform and ecosystem that we are creating to enable, you know, our fellow Papua New Guineans who wants to excel in life or who needs a second chance in life to carry themselves through. Because at the end of the day, they are all doing an amazing job, you know, impacting communities as well. And apart from that, you know, I've been a community person all my life, serving humanity in the rural areas, in which I have a foundation, which is called Voices of Villages Foundation, Inc., that, you know, we help villages, you know, in education, health, sanitation, water, power, and all the basic things that, you know, you can be able to provide and impact the communities that, you know, you serve.
What prompted you to start your own business and also working with various communities in the country?
I think it's not so much prompt, but it's more to the upbringing, basically. You know, you grew up in the village, and as a typical village girl, you know, having to school in the village where, you know, you don't have access to opportunities, where you want to grow yourself, but you're very limited with resources. The only thing you have is your teacher and your classroom. That was it. Our teacher's word were, you know, the information that we needed to learn and build ourselves. So you can imagine the challenges of, you know, no water, no power. You know, we were limited to resources to educate ourselves. And through it all, you progress through those challenges in the villages. And your parents were your foundation. Your parents embedded values and principles and things that you have to do to, you know, serve humanity and kindness to the people. So having to grow up in the villages and then you continue to do your schooling there, went into high school, education system, you know, failed you, that you are unable to go to uni graduates, but that didn't, you know, kill the spirit of me as a young person that wanted to work in an office and do something better for myself and learn things. So, you know, all the experiences and being around people that take you through different routes where you still wanted to pursue your dream. So every time I go out traveling, I always bring it back to rural, because that is where, you know, you need to make a change. And it's because I'm passionately driven and I love what I do, be able to give hope to somebody else. Because if you look at my journey, you know, my mom was my foundation, was somebody who embedded those values and principles and be able to help somebody. So, you know, you bring back those principles and values in your life and your business career. What is your purpose? What is your vision? What is it that you want to achieve through your business, and what solutions you want to provide to impact somebody else?
When you go out into the communities and help people, like with the technology, is that a challenge or are they eager to learn?
Our people are very smart. Our people, you know, they learn by observing, and our people are intelligent too, because if you go back to the village, they don't go to school, but they're doing so many great things, like very skilled, but they're limited to outside. So for me, you know, it's still a challenge, because, you know, I still go back 45 years. I still go back to no power. I still go back to no water. I still go back to some of the places where, you know, there's no road infrastructure to get you to that place. So those are the challenges that you try to see and provide solutions, basically working with the communities to bring my technology, my internet to that place, to give them that access, you know, in the bush, somewhere where they can be able to connect to, you know, access to the world.
You are also involved in promoting local music artists. Tell me about that.
Yes. You know, I love music. And, you know, sometimes, you know, music is something that it inspires you, it motivates you, and it gives you a good feeling and good vibes as well. So, you know, our artists are very talented, but again,
in Papua New Guinea, there's no market for business. So having to have a co-working hub, you know, we have support for, you know, anybody. It doesn't matter what business you are in. So with music, we try to promote talented artists and create entertainment and be able to manage them as well. So we focus on global, international markets. And we have very few, because we're very selective. We want to make sure that artists have good attitude, character, they're talented, their music can sell, and they are marketable. And we've already created those networks and collaborations already where they're already set to excel in their music career and take it as their business and take it seriously, because at the end of the day, you know, that is, music is business and it's also art as well.
PNG businesswoman Vani Nutt is speaking there to the ABC's Caroline Tiriman. More families of Pacific workers in Australia are set to be settled in the country from the middle of the year, but accommodation will likely be a major barrier. The revised Pacific Australia Labor Scheme will include family accompaniment visas for long-term workers, and when it's launched, it will start with a pilot group before expanding. Joining me now is Pacific Islands Council of South Australia Chief Executive Tukini Tavui. Good morning.
Morning, Nick. How are you?
Great, thank you. So how has the news been received by Pacific Islander seasonal workers here in Australia?
Well, naturally, there was a lot of excitement. A lot of people wanted to find out a bit more about it and whether they have the capacity to participate in this initiative. But certainly very positive. I think one of the main elements that this addresses is family separation. So it was very positive. The response was quite positive.
Now, the pilot program will allow for 200 families to join workers in Australia. Do you think that's enough?
Well, I guess we want to sort of, government would like to start with a number that they can manage and really get a good understanding of how that would work. But certainly the numbers to actually meet the entire number of workers will certainly, that number might need to, would definitely need to grow in the future. But certainly, just 200 would be just a starter, obviously, for the purpose of identifying, teething issues and then, continuing to develop that. But I guess that's probably working for the immediate future.
There are more than 800 long-term palm workers alone in South Australia. November 2022, there were 11,610 palm scheme workers on long-term placements. So I guess there is that room for growth, would you say, in the program?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Australia is probably one of the smaller state or territory that has the long-term workers. So I guess it's probably one of the regions or one of the states that are probably in a good position to participate in the pilot.
Now, the program's set to start this year and into next year. From your perspective, what still needs to be addressed before families arrive? Which issues?
Obviously, as you mentioned earlier, accommodation will always be a challenge. I mean, accommodation is a challenge now just for the local community members in some of our regional areas where most of the work are. The community support that they will need, that's something that need to be established. Because at the minute, the local community support is focused on the palms workers. But certainly when that arrives, there's certainly the number of support there will definitely need to increase. So looking at those areas around support, local community connections, which is critical for Pacific Island communities. And obviously the education, health will be, a bit of a challenge because at the minute the government has decided not to include Medicare as part of the service provided to the workers. So that'll be something that we'll need to look at in the future.
With that Medicare issue, as you say, it won't be provided. So employers are likely to have to organise that for families if
what I'm hearing is that, What I'm hearing is that it'll be if it's similar to the current Palms workers, so they're all paying private insurance on a weekly basis. So that'll obviously be done well before they arrive in terms of engaging a private insurer, which is the norm at the moment. But I think that might create some problems down the track. For example, pregnancy, that's around $10,000 for one person to pay. And obviously, if they're bringing children, that's going to add some strain as well. So I think that's probably an area that the government might need to look into more.
The distance between Australia and the Pacific Islands when these workers are on these seasonal schemes is obviously very difficult for families and, it can put quite a lot of stress on families. So how significant is this step for those families to be able to join the seasonal worker, their partners and families in Australia?
I just wanted to clarify one thing. The family accompaniment visa, it's only available to the long-term workers, so it's not available to the seasonal workers. So you've got to be on a visa between 1 to 4 years to participate in this program. The significance of this visa is huge. One of the challenges we're finding now which is really concerning, is around family breakdown. And that's because of the family being separated. A lot of extramarital affairs are starting to, come up, and so it's quite a concern. So I guess one would say that this is really critical for supporting families in this scenario. The other thing is obviously this was highlighted by the Samoan government in one of the meetings that I attended. A father or relationship with the kids, with their children, did suffer a little bit when families, particularly fathers, when they returned home on a 3-year visa, and just the difficulty of reconnecting with their children and providing their role, I guess their role as a father was a bit of a challenge. This is what was noticed, and I'm sure this is right across the 10 countries. So there's a whole range of social issues that would be mitigated when this visa comes into play.
This is Pacific Beats, and I'm speaking with Tukini Tavoy, who is the president of Pacific Islands Council of South Australia. Mr. Tavoy, over the years, we've heard a lot of stories about, exploitation of Pacific Island workers who are here on these programs and safety issues in workplaces. Do you feel like things have improved on that front in recent times?
Definitely. There's improvement in some of the components. For example, employers are now more equipped to manage and support workers, and I'll be referring to just cultural competency. That's a huge component. Cultural competence, understanding the workers and their mindset, where they're coming from, and how can they work with that to bring the best out of them. The other challenge is obviously the support line or the support network that the workers now have was definitely not at this level years ago. So that's available as well now. So workers can be able to contact a community member or go straight to the PLF support line. But it's available now. So we're hearing more. We're getting a lot more data now than what we used to do. We used to because of the communication channels that are now a bit more well established now. And obviously, workers, there's a lot of returnees are coming back, so they really know the system and they know how to manage themselves or challenges, issues that they face, and who to talk to. So this obviously adds to that as well. But certainly, the program is has definitely improved since it started, and those reasons that I've raised and others have certainly contributed to that.
That's certainly encouraging. What do you think families back home in the Pacific need to know before coming to join their family members in Australia?
I guess one of the challenge for all the workers that we work with and from the 10 countries is around just a cultural knowledge or understanding of the Australian culture. A language will also be a very critical, particularly from some of the Pacific countries. that participate in PALMS, they will have to probably do a bit more in terms of equipping them just to have, you know, basic English. And also just around the cost of living and how to manage themselves. And parenting was a huge one. And, you know, I myself came across this. And the way we parent ourselves in Australia, in the islands is quite different to how, you know, parenting is done in Australia. And that's going to be a very important one for parents, just to know the laws and what they can do, what they can't do, those kind of things. But there are certainly, those are probably some of the elements, some of the areas that I think would need to be looked at quite seriously before they depart from their countries.
Certainly. Well, we'll be watching that program pilot with interest to see how things go in the next couple of years, and I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more about it on the program and hopefully speak to you again. So thanks very much, Takini.
Thanks for having me. All the best.
That was Takini Tavoy, the President of Pacific Islands Council of South Australia. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 3 p.m. PNG time. I'm Nick Fogarty. Thanks for your company.
Join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
I'd never been in the political scenario. I had never voted until I voted for myself, but I made this crazy decision to stand, so I knew I had to work really, really hard.
So join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk, Wednesdays at 3:30 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.